This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and this week's A Big Picture. Today, we would like to talk about life inside the bubble. And we're not talking about living in California, in bubble land. We're actually talking about bubble bursting in the markets. And the reason we're discussing that is because most major market tops end when stocks are selling at a high and usually at very extreme prices, which interestingly enough is a lot of times when the average investor tends to jump in when they might want to think about getting out. Right now, this is the second highest priced stock market in history. And every recession and bear market has invariably been preceded by Federal Reserve rate hikes like the ones which we're seeing now. So what that means is every bull market ends up as a bubble which ultimately bursts. And all you have to do is think back to 2000. It really started in 1999, moved into 2000. We had the euphoria of the 1990s with the tech and internet stocks, and that all blew apart in 2000, which, by the way, they managed to offload responsibility for onto 9-1-1, if you remember the politicians did that one. Then we had the 2006-2007, the real estate and the mortgage bubble, and of course, that burst, and we saw what happened after that. So, where are the signs of the bubble today, Jim, I guess is the question we're starting out with. If we look at the record levels of the stock market today, where are the signs of the bubble?
Well, I mean, John, it's really hard to cite any one particular industry. You can't say it's tech stocks, but some of these tech stocks are getting very pricey, as we talked last week on the program with the Fab Five. But we think we've uncovered the bubble. And the bubble is in index funds, in ETFs, in passive investing. Now, no thinking or no work to invest in an index fund. And this is the fad and the rage right now. If most money managers, fund managers are having a hard time beating the index, as they are, because it's been a very unpredictable market. And you saw that following the election. Nobody was in predicting what would ensue after Trump's victory. In fact, they were predicting the opposite. In fact, George Soros lost $1 billion shorting stocks after Trump's victory, thinking that the market would collapse. Instead of collapsing, we are now at record levels. So passive investing has been the fad in the fashion. And we'll get into some statistics. And the nice thing about it, you just put your money in an S&P index fund, a Dow index fund, or a NASDAQ index fund. And most of these index funds beat most money managers. And the idea is you take a long-term approach. You just put your money in an S&P index fund, allow it to ride as it has. Since the stock market bottom in 2009, the stock market is up over 250%. So how can you argue with this thinking?
Yeah. And Jim, doesn't that usually come in when people perceive that there's been a trend? And it's usually a long running trend. So the tendency is to think it's going to go up and up and up and up and never turn around. It's going to go a long time into the future. That's where the psychology comes in.
Well, sure, because the stock market has been going up for 8 years into this bull market. The other thing, too, that's being sold to the public is the historical returns in the market over the last 100 years. And the stock market has averaged 10% a year. However, people aren't looking at where the stock market has averaged over the last 17 years, where the rates of return are probably closer to 3% and 4% than they are 10%. Because from the year 2000, till April of 2013, the stock market, as represented by the S&P, went nowhere.
Okay, so why do you think that the bubble's in passive funds indexing? I mean, I know that's all the rage right now, but unlike what we saw going on in the 90s and first part of the 2000s, there was didn't seem to be any particular industry that stood out. At one time it was tech, then it was real estate. Now, some stocks are selling at bubble-like valuations. There's Netflix and Amazon and the Fab Five. So is this bubble lurking in that area?
Well, it sort of is. We're doing a lot of research right now because we know we're in a Fed rate raising cycle, and we know what that usually ends up. It ends up in a recession, and it ends up in a bear market. So we're looking at where are the areas most vulnerable. And as we talked about last week, we saw valuations of Amazon, which are 177 times earnings, or Netflix at 205 times earnings. And we've been doing a lot of research in this area, and we're trying to look at, I really thought to myself, what fund manager on Wall Street would be sitting there, at 205 times earnings, I need to buy Netflix. Or at 177 times earnings, I need to buy Amazon. Now, there is a group of investors, as we talked about last week, momentum investors, that's what they do. They just jump on board on anything that's going up the most. But as you look at the indexing, and as we began to do this research, we start looking at the major indexes, and bear with me here if you're a professional, but for our regular investors, you have to understand the way the markets work is the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are what we call market-weighted indexes. And what that means is you take the number of shares outstanding times the price of those shares, that makes up the market value of a company. And so you have companies like Amazon that are worth $500 billion or Apple over $500 billion. And what that means is when you put money in an index fund, that index fund goes out and buys the 500 stocks in the S&P 500. But it's based on the market weight. And here's the real key here in what is driving the valuations of a lot of these stocks. And I'm just going to go over the NASDAQ and the S&P in the top 10 stocks. But you're going to understand where I'm going with this when I say that the bubble is in index funds and ETFs. If you take the S&P 500, Apple has a weight. Now, there's 500 stocks, but Apple has a weight of over 3.5%. Facebook has a weight of 1.6%. Amazon has a weight of 1.7%. Microsoft has a weight of 2.5%. And the two Google stocks, the two alphabets, A and C, have a weight of roughly about 2.5%. And then you have Philip Morris, Visa, Home Depot. Now, if you go over to the NASDAQ, Apple has a weight of 12%. Amazon has a weight of 7%, and the two alphabets, A and C, have a weight of 9%. Microsoft has a weight of 8%, and Facebook has a weight of 5.5%. Now, let's put this into perspective, and what does this mean? And you'll begin to understand how this is driving this bubble. So as indexing has become more popular as an investment, so let's say the spiders, which is the S&P 500, let's say they take in $100 million of new money. What that means is any index fund that mirrors the S&P 500 is automatically going to buy close to 4% of Apple. They're going to buy close to 2% in Facebook, close to 2% in Amazon, close to 2.5% in Microsoft and Alphabet. So as the more money that comes into an index fund, you have to understand an index fund manager does not sit there and say, wait a minute, do I really want to buy Amazon at 177 times earnings? No, I'm not going to do that. You don't think it. It's effortless. It's computerized. It just happens automatically. So the more money that keeps flowing into these passive index funds, the more money keeps going into these stocks that are highly valued, from Facebook to Amazon to Alphabet. Likewise, on the NASDAQ, it's the same weighting of these stocks.
So what you're saying here, Jim, is that we're seeing record amounts of money going into index funds, but as this money is flowing in, it doesn't seem like there are any valuation decisions, or is this stock reasonably priced or overpriced? And nevertheless, the trend just keeps continuing. Basically, what you're saying here, it's becoming a self-feeding dragon or frenzy. It's feeding itself and it just picks up momentum and keeps on going.
Yeah. And what's interesting is we took a look at where's the money coming from. So today we have mutual funds and we have ETFs. And if we take a look at since 1998, mutual funds have grown from $5.5 trillion in equities to almost $15.6 trillion, and that's an annual growth rate of about 6%. But here's where the real growth has taken place, and that's in ETFs. ETFs have grown from $16 million to $2.1 trillion as of 2015. John, that's an annual growth rate of 33%. And if you dig in much closer, index funds have gone from a little over $300 billion to now $2.2 trillion at the end of 2015. Index funds have been growing at an annual rate of 16% and almost at an annual rate of over 20% to 25% since 2008. So one of the things I began to notice over the last 2 years, when I look at investing in a stock, one of the things that we have on our Bloomberg is I can press a button on my Bloomberg, or we have the entire Value Line database, and I can take a look at who are the largest owners of this stock. So, I don't know, take a look at, say I'm looking at Exxon, IBM, or whoever it is. We used to see large mutual fund families. We saw hedge funds. Sometimes we saw individuals. Sometimes we saw companies like Berkshire Hathaway. When I look at who owns a lot of these stocks today, they're mainly ETFs and they're mainly index funds. And I'll give you an example of this. Let's take Amazon and Netflix. Who's the largest owner of Amazon? It's the SPDRs, the S&P 500 Trust. It's the PowerShare Qs. It's iShares Core. It's iShares Russell. It's iShares S&P. It's iShares Russell. There's two major Russell indexes, 2 and 3,000. And then it's also Vanguard Consumer Index, Vanguard Large Cap. If you look at Netflix, you'll find the same thing. Who's the largest owner of Netflix? The SPDRs, the Qs, the iShares Cores, the iShares Russell, the iShares S&P, the iShares Russell 3000, and the large cap Vanguard stocks. So what you're seeing is these large index funds, which are taking in huge, huge amounts of money, because especially since the beginning of the year, the rage over the last couple of years in the market has been ETFs and ETF index funds. And so when I began to look at doing some valuations, because you're looking at extremes, whether you're looking at Amazon or you're looking at Netflix, you're looking at these stocks and you're saying to yourself, who in their right mind is paying 177 times earnings or 205 times earnings? Folks, that's the same kind of stuff that the goofy kind of pricing that we saw with internet stocks and technology stocks in the late 90s, which came to a huge bust. And I was thinking to myself, and so as we dug deeper and deeper and deeper, this whole thing is being fed by the growth of ETFs, which have grown by 33% a year. And the vast amount of money that's going into ETFs are going into these passive indexes. People are buying either a Dow Industrial ETF, S&P 500 ETF, a Russell ETF, a NASDAQ ETF. That's where all this money is going. They're saying, you know what? Just put your money in a passive index and you'll have the returns of the market. And so it is now feeding on itself as more and more money comes into these index funds. These index funds are forced by the very nature of what they are made up of. They are going to be forced to go out and buy. For example, if you have a NASDAQ ETF, it is going to go out. If it takes in $100 million, it's going to spend $12 million on Apple alone. It's going to spend $7 million on Amazon. It's going to spend $9 million on Google. and it's going to spend $8 million on Microsoft and $6 million on Facebook. So as more and more dollars are coming in, these decisions are just being made automatically, and that's what's driving these prices.
So in this situation, fundamental analysis doesn't seem to be applying to these markets at all. I mean, it's a self-feeding frenzy. And right now, it's all the rage with passive index funds. That seems to be where it's going. But if you were to look at it from the point of view of someone who examines the fundamentals of investments, how would you view what's going on right now?
You know, I did that for both Amazon and also for Netflix. And if you take a look at the number one retailer in the world, in the U.S., is still Walmart. Number two retailer is Amazon. They have now overtaken Costco. And number three is Costco. So I took a look at this and I broke it down into sales, profits, margin, market cap, price earnings. And then I also even looked at growth rates. If you look at Amazon, last year they had sales of roughly $143 billion. They had profits of $2.6 billion. Amazon's profit margin is 1.8%, and it has a market cap of $450 billion and a P/E ratio of 177. You take a look at Costco. Costco last year had sales of about $121 billion. They had profits of about $2.4 billion. Their profit margin is 1.9%, so slightly better than Amazon. Their market cap, however, is only $79 billion. They're selling at 34 times earnings. And finally, the big gorilla, Walmart, has sales of $486 billion. They have profits of almost $13.7 billion. And believe it or not, they have the highest profit margin of 2.8%. Walmart's profit margin is 1% larger than Amazon's. Now, Walmart's market cap is about $230 billion, and it's selling at $18 million. So let's look at this from another perspective. If you put together Costco and Walmart together, they have annual sales of $608 billion, an annual profit of $16 billion, and their market cap combined is about a little over $300 billion. You take a look at that compared to Amazon. Amazon has a market cap of $450 billion. So the two combined have, if you take Walmart and Costco, they have $465 billion more in sales, and they have more than $13.5 billion in profits. If you take a look at what you're getting with Walmart, you could divide it into Amazon by 10 times, Costco by 5 times. Now, so a lot of people say, well, yeah, but the growth rates of Amazon have been much higher. And that's absolutely true. The annualized rate of change over the last 5 years, and it was a little over 27% for 10 years. It's down to 27% in 5 years. And that growth rate is slowing down to about 20% projected for the next 5 years. Now, you compare that to the annual rates of change of companies like Walmart, where their sales were up 7.5% over 10 years, up 5% over 5 years, and it's projected to grow at 5%. Likewise with Costco. Costco has been growing at about 9% a year in sales, almost 8% the last 5 years. So the market is basically saying Amazon is growing at a much faster rate. But does it make sense for Amazon? Well, let's put it this way. You can buy almost 4 times the amount of sales with a combination of Costco in Walmart. And we did this and we looked at the same thing with Netflix. And, you know, if you type in Bloomberg, okay, what are the equivalent companies that compete with Netflix? On our Bloomberg, it was CBS, Discovery Channel, Disney, Time Warner, and 20th Century Fox. And we found the same thing. And I'm not going to read it all, but the average profit margins for this industry are between 13 in 17%. The highest profit margin in the industry is Disney, which has profit margins close to 17%. And if you take a look at the PE ratios of competing companies, probably the highest would be Disney, which is close to 20 times earnings. It's the big gorilla in the entertainment. And you compare that to Netflix, which has a PE ratio of 205, and Netflix has the lowest profit margins in the industry. Netflix profit margins are 2.1% compared to an industry average of 13%. So when you look at all this from a fundamental point of view, and this was kind of one of the things I've been doing in a lot of the research I've been doing since the beginning of the year, because we're trying to get a handle and a shape of how this bull market is going to end. We know that the Fed will cause it, but we want to take a look at what areas of the market are most vulnerable. And we start looking at these Fab Five stocks. We start looking at some of the valuations of some of these stocks. And we were saying, who in their right mind is feeding it? And the closer and closer I began to look, as I start looking at all these companies, I began to see a similar pattern. It was the index funds that became the largest owners. And then we started tracking the flow of money that was going into these index funds, and it is just mushrooming. So it is becoming a self-feeding frenzy. So if you want to know where the bubble is, you can't say, okay, it is the tech industry. Well, yes, in some ways, it'll end up being the tech industry, because the very nature of the market cap weight of these tech stocks that are in the indexes, as I pointed out, you know, if you take a look at, you know, whether you're buying the Qs or you're buying an S&P, the largest capital weighting is going to these tech stocks, from Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, to Google or Alphabet. And it's likewise the same thing with the NASDAQ.
So as we can see, there is a bubble, and it's indexed ETFs and indexing ETF investing. And no one seems to be able to pick up on this. I mean, at least no one's warning the people what could happen in a bear market, because the very index funds that drove these stocks up to just the incredible valuations you've been talking about, when that breaks, could turn around and be precipitous in the downfall.
Oh, absolutely. It goes in the reverse direction. And the best example I can give you is the S&P peaked in October of 2007 at 1576. It bottomed in March of 2009 at 666. It dropped by 58%. So if you were in, let's say, the Spider ETF or an S&P index fund, you lost close to 60% of your money. And John, what do you think is going to happen when the next bear market begins? And all these people that are in these index ETFs, I don't care if it's Qs, Russell, NASDAQ, the Dow, and they start seeing their stocks drop 20%, their funds drop 20-something percent a year, as we saw happen in 2008 and 2009, where you saw these double-digit drops. It's going to happen the same thing. So just as a good example is you're in an S&P 500 index fund, and all of a sudden the accounting department comes to the trade desk and says, we just had liquidations of 100 million. Well, guess what? You're going to sell, if you're an S&P 500, you're going to sell 3.5 million of Apple. If you're in a NASDAQ fund, you're going to sell 12% of Apple. You're going to sell 7% of Amazon. You're going to sell 9% of Google. You're going to sell 8% in Microsoft or 6% in Facebook. So what goes up to the same magnitude goes down in the same magnitude, but it happens much faster. The one thing about bull markets that distinguish them from bear markets, bull markets take time and momentum to build. So if you take a look at the market, stock market is up over 250%, but it took 8 years to get there. If you take a look at the bear market that began in late fall of 2007, it lost 60% in a year and a half. So bear markets happen much quicker. The drops are much deeper. And that's when panic sets in. So the thing about a bear market, it's quick, it's devastating, and it happens over a short period of time. I mean, you could be down 20, 25% before you even know it, before you start thinking, oh my God, what's going on here? And then when you see those big drops, that's when the public psychologically changes and all of a sudden the mood flips and goes in the opposite direction. So things go reverse to extremes, just as we saw in March of 2009. By that time, the S&P 500 lost close to 60% of its value. So what is driving these valuations today is passive investing coming in the form of either mutual fund indexes or ETF indexes. And John, what we do know is we have the second highest valuations in stock market history. And the other thing we know, and we got an indication this week, the Fed still plans on raising interest rates, and they will keep raising, and they will keep raising until they do what they always do, which is crash land the airplane. But anyway, you want to know where there is a bubble? It's in passive indexing investing.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I work for the Biometric Research Group. We publish biometricupdate.com, and we also do market research. And one of the key reports that we just published is the Biometrics and Healthcare Report, which we published at the beginning of May of 2017. And in that, we basically define healthcare biometrics as biometric applications in doctor's offices, in hospitals, or for the use and monitoring of patients. And the next stage in the technical revolution will be biochemical sensors that basically monitor and record biorhythms from within the body. I think that's the way that the technology is going. There is going to be a linkage between these medical biometrics, these technologies that are tracking biorhythms, accessing sensors that are interacting with your body directly, and integrating those with healthcare biometric processes or processes that feed into the system. Of course, there are going to be some ethical considerations when we do that, but I think the reality is we're going to see more innovation and more pressures to link those innovations to existing technologies and to the system itself.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you as the big picture continues. Since hitting a high in April at $53.76 oil as of Friday, the prices have dropped almost 14%. We're back in the mid-40s with a lot of worries out there over U.S. oil shale. And there are serious doubts being raised in the market that OPEC will keep up with production cuts. I mean, remember what's happened is that U.S. shale has disrupted the OPEC pattern. And the question is, where will the markets head right now? Inventory levels are not coming down as fast as people would like. Everybody is focusing on what's going on in the U.S. and generally not reading what's going on elsewhere. So now the question remains, where is the status of the oil markets? Are we going to see lower prices, or will OPEC extend its production cuts into the second half of the year? Or maybe we're just degenerating into a great big free-for-all like it used to be a long time ago.
You know, John, it's my view that you're going to see oil production cuts extended into the second half of the year. The Russians seem to be going along, and there's widespread consensus within OPEC. If we look at compliance, this has always been a difficult issue for OPEC, but we're seeing 100% compliance. And basically, OPEC is deepening its oil production cuts as a lot of the laggards in the production cut agreement are improving their compliance. So here's some things that the market really isn't picking up. In the U.S., inventories are starting to drop. They've dropped now for the third straight week at Cushing. Latest week, they dropped by 728,000 barrels to 66 million barrels. And if we take a look at the trend, and this is, I think, more important, the markets tend to focus on a daily basis or the news of the day. If you take a look at the last 4 weeks, U.S. oil production is up about 66,000 barrels a day. Oil imports into this country. A lot of people think that the U.S. is energy independent. No, we still import about half our oil. So oil imports into this country are up over 1 million barrels a day, which means that oil demand is increasing. If you want to look at crude inventory, in the last month, crude inventories have dropped by almost 8.2 million barrels. The other thing that is happening is usually in the spring, you see your refiners shut down for maintenance production because they're getting ready to ramp up for the summer driving season. We are now back up to 94% utilization rates at our refineries, and the maintenance period for refineries are over as they start ramping up for the big demand season that's going to begin here in the U.S. with Memorial Day weekend. And here's the thing that isn't pointed out, because everybody's talking about shale. Okay, so we have basically five major shale regions in the United States. John, there's only one that has increased its production and is up over the decline, and that's the Permian Basin. The Eagle Ford, the Bakken are still in a declining trend, while others are basically flat. And here's one of the things that happened, and you're seeing this in first quarter earnings. I mean, everyone from companies as large as Exxon, the international oil companies, Exxon reported earnings. They were up 100% over last year, and a lot of the, even the smaller companies are making a profit. There was a survey that was done last year, and they basically talked to the oil companies, at what price would you like to see oil before you start ramping up production? And they said somewhere around $55 a barrel. Well, guess what? We got to that this year at $55 a barrel. And what happened is over that period of time when oil was up in that region, almost 80% of U.S. shale production is hedged, meaning that the shale producers locked in their price in the 50s to $55 a barrel for future delivery. And so what the oil companies were saying, hey, if we can get $55, we went into the futures market, they've locked in their production for the year at higher prices. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these oil companies that are reporting higher profits. You're seeing these results reflected in earnings. As I mentioned, Exxon doubled. You're seeing the same thing with large companies like Royal Dutch. You're seeing it at Chevron. And we are now about to begin the strongest seasonal demand period for refinery utilization as we head into the summer driving months.
So it seems, however, that the financial channels are still only focusing on inventory numbers. It seems like there are perceptions in the market that follow these old standard lines and fears that OPEC won't cut. So despite what we saw this week, there's all this hesitancy floating in the markets.
Well, I mean, this is going to sound very strange, but I think we're building ourselves up for another shock in either direction. Either a shock up in the price that will surprise everybody and take the markets by surprise, or a shock in the opposite direction where the price of oil collapses. And I can guarantee you, if OPEC comes May 25th and they say, hey, we're not going to extend our production cuts into the second half of the year, the price of oil is definitely going down. We're going to be back to $30 a barrel, just as we were in the lows of last year. So you will see a precipitous drop in the price of oil, and you will see the same repeat of what we saw with shale producers between 2014 in 2015. I happen to think that all indications are with 100% compliance, and especially with some of the lagging members, also indications coming from Russia. The last thing the Russians want to see right now is $30 oil. And I can't think of one OPEC member country that wants to see $30 oil, because they know the power of U.S. shale production. And they know what will happen when Saudi Arabia made that decision in November 2014. They're saying, you know what, we're just going to keep pumping. I'm sorry, but we're not going to cut back on oil production just by ourselves. Sorry, guys, you're on your own. And that really got everybody's attention. And everybody knows if they don't cooperate with Saudi Arabia, they could very well do the same thing. And then it's going to be a free fall. So we're setting ourselves up for a shock in another direction. But I think there's something bigger at play here. We are now into what I call the fifth phase of the oil industry in the coming age of volatility.
Well, now you have my attention on this one because it sounds ominous. The coming age of volatility because, let's face it, everybody, after we managed to stabilize the markets for so many years, sort of followed in that direction. So this would seem to be a major change as I'm hearing it. What would it look like?
Well, let me give you a little bit of historical background because you have to put this in perspective. If you go back to the 19th century to 1859 when Drake made his first oil discovery, the industry itself boomed. I mean, everybody that could dig a hole in the ground was digging a hole in the ground as oil was discovered, and it became a new source for lighting. Because all of a sudden now you could turn evening into daylight with kerosene lamps. And so it was just absolute chaos. You would see these boom bust cycles, and they would happen almost every single year where you could see the price of oil go to $10 a barrel and drop to 10 cents a barrel until a guy by the name of John D. Rockefeller came in. And he began to see this disorder in the markets, and he began to consolidate the markets to the point by 1879, Rockefeller controlled 90% of the refineries in the United States. And you had a period of stability with Standard Oil that lasted between 1880 and 1911 until basically the Supreme Court broke up Standard Oil Trust. And then what happened is we went from order to chaos because we began the second phase of oil, which lasted between 1911 and 1933. Now, fortunately for oil, as Standard Oil was busted, now you had this regulator that was regulating the oil markets and bringing stability. You had a great demand for oil with the beginning of World War I, because what was World War I? It was our first mechanized war. You had tanks, you had trucks to move troops, you had airplanes, and you had this mass consumption of oil that lasted between 1914 and 1919. And then we had a drop in the price of oil. But then the second thing that happened that drove the price of oil was Henry Ford in the automobile. And so that drove a lot of demand for automobiles that took up a lot of that slack in the market. But then all of a sudden, we got to the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, the price of oil collapsed. We had volatility like we've never seen before. And we also had, at the same time, one of the largest oil discoveries in Texas. By the 1930s, Texas was producing almost 50% of the country's oil. And what happened is there was so much chaos that basically the government came in through the Texas Railroad Commission and did the same thing to the oil industry that Rockefeller had done with Standard Oil. In fact, John, I was watching on Netflix, if you have the chance to watch it, it's called The Prize, Daniel Yergin's book. It's an 8-part series. And I was watching during the 1930s when the Texas Railroad Commission came in. I mean, they literally had sheriffs right in with guns to a lot of these oil producing sites to enforce production cuts. And so then we went into the third phase of oil, which was a period of stability between 1934 and 1972. And it was controlled by the U.S. and the Seven Sisters, or the big seven international oil companies. There's no longer Seven Sisters. A lot of these got bought up. Texaco got bought up. Exxon bought Mobil. Soquel got bought up. However, in 1972, the U.S. government, the Texas Railroad Commission, and the Seven Sisters lost control over oil with the birth of OPEC, which began in the 1960s. Then we began what is called the fourth phase of oil, which lasted between 1970 and 1980, where basically OPEC A lot of these companies nationalized their oil fields from the big international Seven Sisters. Between 1981 and 1991, OPEC had a rude awakening and they lost control of enforcing pricing. And the pricing of the oil markets moved from OPEC to the trading exchanges in New York and London. And then we went through a brief period of stability between 1991 and 2003. But basically, beginning in 2004 and 2008, OPEC lost control over the price of oil. They were unable to prevent the rise in oil as a result of increased demand coming from emerging markets, especially China. So oil went from $20 to $50 to $70 and finally to $150. Now, what we have entered into is what I call phase five, oil's third boom bust cycle as a result of American shale. Saudi Arabia has dwindling spare capacity and no longer can do to the oil markets. They were unable to prevent the rise of oil as they did in the past in the 1980s. They could not stop the price of oil rising as it did from $50 a barrel in 2005 to its peak in the summer of 2008 when it hit. And the other thing you have to understand is with oil fields, especially the old producing oil fields, they go through various stages. Typical oil field will get about 35% of its production, and then they typically go to what we call enhanced oil recovery. If you want to understand shale oil, drillers go right to the extended oil recovery stage. Shale oil is not produced from a reservoir like you have a typical oil well, but instead it's out of source rock thousands of feet. So shale oil production rises and falls much faster than oil from a typical conventional field. A good example of this is in the Bakken oil field, the oil declines by 65% in the first year production, 35% in the second year, 15% in the third, and 10% in the fourth year. So if you're in the shale business, you constantly have to be drilling new wells because the well depletion operates at a much faster level.
This new phase you're discussing here seems to have broad implications. So what do you foresee the effects on the oil market being?
Basically, John, we're entering a new era of boom and bust. There are no controlling factors regulating the oil market the way Standard Oil did, the way the Texas Railroad Commission did, or the way OPEC did over the last 150 years. There is an epic transition that took place in the global oil markets from 2008 to 2014 as it became clear there was no swing producer able and willing to regulate production with the goal of stabilizing oil prices. Saudi Arabia, once again, was unable to prevent the price spikes of 2008, and they refused to prevent a price bust in 2014. So in either direction, on rising prices or falling prices, Saudi Arabia said, we're not going to do this anymore. So these twin episodes point to a clear demonstration that there is no swing producer who has enough market concentration and control and is willing and able to adjust production to stabilize prices. Because one of the things that are required is market control to become a swing producer. The U.S. shale producers can't do it, nor can OPEC or Saudi Arabia. So if you take a look at the oil markets over the last 10 years, they've demonstrated the market is now operating without a safety net like a Standard Oil or like OPEC or the Texas Railroad Commission to come in there. When things get crazy, when everybody's drilling and the price starts to collapse, there's nobody that comes in there to stabilize it. So the semblance of a price ceiling imposed by Saudi Arabia was shattered when prices soared to $145 in December 2008, which a price peak that coincided with Saudi Arabia's essentially running out of spare capacity. and as Saudi Arabia's loss of spare capacity production resembles in 1972 when the Texas Railroad Commission ran out of spare capacity with U.S. oil production peaking in 1971. So if we've learned anything since 2014, there's nobody out there that can put a floor truly under the price of oil. Market has become too big to manage successfully on its own, and OPEC as a cartel has not been and never able to be cohesive enough to hunker down. Basically, Saudi Arabia no longer has market controls as it once did. And basically, John, it's a whole brave new world where the price of oil is likely to go to the bus like we saw in the early part of 2016 when you saw the price of oil drop to $26 a barrel, very similar to the drop in oil during 2008 where it went from almost $150 a barrel down to $30 a barrel. So the moral of this story is fasten your seatbelt. It is going to be one wild ride.
So if we are heading to another oil shock, what will drive it?
Well, you know, the one thing that hasn't stopped, as I mentioned, shale wells deplete very rapidly, 65% the first year and within a four-year period. The other thing that is occurring in a lot of these bigger oil fields that have been discovered, like the North Sea, Prudhoe Bay, Canarel in Mexico, a lot of these older oil fields are in steady decline. So the depletion rate is between 3 and 4% globally. John, that continues year in and year out. That is not stopping. The second thing that we've seen as a result of the drop of oil is a lot of the major oil companies and even some of the countries have forestalled investment, literally hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of new oil investment have come to a stop. Oil companies are basically saying, we can't make these multi-billion dollar investments because we have no predictability in terms of what our returns are going to be. And then the other thing is there's no controlling entity. There is no Texas Railroad Commission. There is OPEC. The best that they can do is extend these cuts into the second half of the year, and we may even be extending them next year. Because what happens if we get into a global recession in 2018, where, for example, the Fed brings us into the next recession, and we know what happens in a recession, the demand for energy drops. Right now, global energy demand is growing on a sustainable basis. We're seeing it globally in China. We're seeing it now in India. We're seeing it around the globe. But if we get into an economic downturn, there'll be less demand for oil. So sooner or later in the next 4 years, we are going to see an oil shock because there has not been the adequate investment by the major oil companies. There has not been the adequate investment by producing nations within OPEC themselves. And if you put somebody in a car in China or in a motor scooter, you now have a permanent oil consumer. And so that's why I say fasten your seatbelts. We're back to the wild age of oil, just as it existed in the 19th century, where you had these thousands of drillers that were going out drilling for oil, just as you have today in the shale boom in the U.S. There is no controlling factor. So it's sooner or later, I don't know if it's going to be a government entity or somebody, will have to bring some kind of stability, because like it or not, it is the most valuable commodity in the U.S. And even though we have electric cars, hybrid cars, you get on a jet or you get on a boat to transport goods or you get in your car, it still runs on oil. Transportation, 96% still runs on oil. So that's why we've entered what I call the fifth phase of the oil age, a new age of volatility and instability.
So as we round out the show here, Jim, do you have a time frame for all of this? I mean, is it imminently upon us where we're going to start seeing this, or will we phase into it, so to speak?
I think you're going to see it within the next 4 years, because I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Royal Dutch, all the big major integrated oil companies, and also the state-run oil companies are not making new investments. If you take a look at Saudi Arabia and their Aramco IPO, which is expected next year, Saudi Arabia wants to turn itself into an integrated oil company. The proceeds are going to be used to develop its petrochemicals and refineries and become more of an integrated oil company. oil company. And they're not saying we're going to take these proceeds and we're going to spend $100 billion or $50 billion, whatever they raise, and then all of a sudden put that money into increase exploration, or what we call upstream, finding oil. It's just not going to happen. Nobody wants to make those big investments. And we're not seeing it at the state level. We're not certainly seeing it at the free market area with oil companies. The big companies are just sitting back. They can't, John. The price of oil is so unpredictable. You're not going to spend $2 billion when you don't know what the price of oil is going to be. That's why if you see a lot of the major oil companies have moved into shale, because it's safer. Because you know you get your returns back in the first couple of years, so you don't have to worry so much long term for what the price of oil is going to be.
So having said all of that, Jim, what are we looking forward to? Not so much 4 years ahead, but in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we're pretty much going to be wrapping up earnings season by the end of May. And I suppose at the end of May, we'll be talking about the next Fed rate hike, which will come in June. What's going to be rather interesting, John, is GDP growth was less than 1%. They're expecting a little bit stronger economic growth in the second quarter. But John, there's no way we're going to be hitting the 2-2.5% economic growth. So it's going to be interesting what the Fed says after it raises interest rates in June. Because if you look at the futures markets, it doesn't expect the third hike to come until December. I would be really surprised if we start to see, unless we get tax cuts coming from the Trump administration in infrastructure spending, tax cuts would be the fastest way to stimulate the economy. But without some form of government stimulus coming in the form of tax cuts, infrastructure spending, John, it's going to be interesting to see if we start to see these economic indicators begin to roll over, as I suspect they will, in Q3 and Q4, with a weak Q2 going forward. And that's the things that we're watching very, very closely. So right now, we're finishing up earnings season, and I'm sure in another couple of weeks, we'll be talking about the next Fed rate hike, and also what's going to happen with some of these economic numbers, especially if they start to weaken consecutively month after month. All of a sudden, we're going to have a new topic to talk about, a weakening U.S. economy. So in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.